This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Today we're in Rodez.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're in a very hot Rodez. It's absolutely scorching here, isn't it? I think, well, we're stood in the shade, fortunately, outside whatever this building is. It's an amphitheatre, but it's not an amphitheatre, is it? It's just some kind of volleyball stadium.
Volleyball stadium. Good insight. My name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney, who you just heard, and Daniel Freeb.
Ciao.
Daniel, is it?
Sorry. It feels a bit odd to be back.
Here we are, three British men drinking glasses of rosé, which is a reference to a comment made in last night's podcast by François Thomazot, our French colleague who stood in for Daniel, but he's back now, and maybe hear the fruits of his secret mission in a kilometre zero next week. So today's stage, Lionel, can you just give us the nuts and bolts of what happened?
Stage 13 to Rodez. Big break went away. Not big in size, but they got a decent advantage and they stayed away quite close to the finish. There was quite a bit of jumping about in that break. Nathan Haas had a little dig. So did Cyril Gauthier and
Perrichon.
Perrichon was in the break.
You're Cyril... talking about attack from the break.
Yeah.
I'm glad you were watching this closely.
It's very hot, Richard. It's really hot. It's addled my brain.
It's so hot that when Chris Froome went to his leader's press conference, he took off his yellow jersey in order to try and cool down a bit. It's really hot. And it was a harder stage than I think they would have liked, obviously, maybe anticipated. There aren't many easy stages on this tour. But it was, he said, the last 40Ks, when they realised the break was possibly going to stay away, the heat was on.
Yeah, my brain has rebooted. It was Cyril Gauthier and Thomas de Gendt who were away, and all of that was then swept up on the closing kilometres. And as you say, Richard, the climb up to Rodez, the last 500 metres of road, was steeper than I think a lot of people thought. When it came down to it, it was a shootout, really, between Greg Van Avermaet and Peter Sagan.
Well, it was a thrilling finish. I mean, it was that kind of climb that was just deadening. It's 500 metres long, just ramped up a little bit, and in this heat it looked like the tar was melting under their wheels. That's what it looked like.
Well, I don't know if you chaps have looked at the results, but they're absolutely extraordinary. The stage perhaps wasn't the most exciting, but the results are amazing. It looks like a high mountain stage. The time gaps and almost no groups came in together. Everyone just came in dribs and drabs. People really scattered all over that climb, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, in the end, it came down to Greg Van Avermaet. We should probably mention the stage winner at some point. And Peter Sagan, Jan Bakelants was just behind him. John Degenkolb, who was certainly fancied for the stage, was up there. His team, Giant Alpecin, did a lot of work to try and bring the break back. They were busy all day. But think of Saxo were also busy, which might be a sign that they're, less confident in Alberto Contador. That certainly seems to be the message coming from the Tinkoff Saxo team, that they've given up on him, doing the Giro Tour double. And so they were able to help Peter Sagan a little bit today. And it was the blogger in a ring made a very funny comment about the philosophical puzzle of Greg Van Avermaet and Peter Sagan, two riders renowned for finishing second, going head-to-head. Maybe it was like a slow race, wasn't it? I mean, It was brutal. They were on their last legs. It looked like Sagan had Van Avermaet, because Van Avermaet went a long way out, really. Sagan clawed his way back to his wheel, sat there. You were just waiting for him to pull the trigger, but he couldn't locate it. And a lot of people said, when's he going to go? When's he going to go? And he said at the end that he'd made a mistake, but I think he just ran out of legs.
Yeah, I mean, he did kind of go, didn't he? And he got level, if not past, Van Avermaet, and then Van Avermaet found something else. So it was a real, as I say, a shootout of a finish at the end of a fairly unremarkable stage. So almost four and three quarter hours of pedalling, and then a thrilling finish, which I suppose, better than just having a routine finish to what had already been a fairly routine-ish day. But as Daniel mentions, when you look at the results, you see the toll it's taken on people. A lot of those time gaps are probably people sitting up in the last 10 kilometres or so when, or perhaps even closer to the finish than that. A day to survive and tick off rather than a sort of an overall thrilling day on the tour.
Chris Froome was to the fore and came in sixth. Nibali, Contador, Valverde, Van Garderen, Quintana all sort of queuing up behind him. But He looked sprightly again. I mean, it's a sign of good form, Chris Froome.
You would think he'd be in good form, given he's in the yellow jersey leading the Tour de France.
He's not the only one in the yellow jersey, Daniel. You're in a yellow Pedlar de Charme jersey that I believe was destined for Thibaut Pinot.
You would think he's quite a good cyclist and cycling quite well at the moment if he was leading the world's biggest bike race.
I hope you're not going to be as facetious as this on French radio, which you're going on quite soon.
You mentioned Nibali. Going back to the serious business, Nibali said that he had two tyres explode today. He said the heat was absurd. Ridiculous. As though this was some elaborate Kazakh ploy to turn the heat up today.
The Sicilian complaining about the heat. That's something quite remarkable. Greg Van Avermaet, I read that somebody put on Twitter that he's leaving the race on Tuesday because his wife is pregnant and expecting a baby. Is that correct, Daniel?
I think it is. Just on Sagan, I think today the finale really did underline how Sagan has gone backwards. You know, a lot of people paid a lot of attention to this incredible sequence of placings he's got in the Tour de France this year and also in the last two or three years. But the finish really reminded me of 2012, the finish in Serang, just outside Liège. It was very, very similar. The way on that occasion he climbed onto Fabian Cancellara's wheel and then just really made a fool of Cancellara, came round in one very easily. He looked to be doing the same today to Greg Van Avermaet, only to completely die on his wheel.
I was watching old footage from 2012, old footage, black and white footage from 2012, of some of Sagan's moments from that tour. He won three stages. He's a different build. He's a completely different build. He was a very young rider in those days. That was his first tour, wasn't it? He was 22 at the time. So he's 25 now. He's really bulky, and he's becoming bulkier and bulkier as he gets older. You know, obviously that gives him great strength, but is it handicap as well, perhaps?
Well, I wonder whether it's a psychological thing as much as anything. Now, I'm not saying in those specific circumstances his mind switched off or he went wandering, but we've seen in the past riders who've been very accomplished, but they get on this kind of cycle of just not winning, and he just needs something to break that cycle. I think it's that 15 second places that he's had in the Tour. I remember back in the 80s, Sean Kelly went a lot of years. You know, he'd win the green jersey or be very close in the green jersey, but couldn't win stages.
Eric Zabel as well.
Eric Zabel as well, exactly. You know, I think won six green jerseys, but went on a long, long run. Very consistent finisher. Sagan's not a pure sprinter. He's more in the Sean Kelly mould, really.
He's like a centre-forward footballer who just has completely lost the knack. Like a Fernando Torres or a Roberto Soldado, isn't he?
Yeah, you can say the same of those guys. He's still very, very, very good at cycling. His consistency is remarkable. Season-long consistency in such a variety of races. Well, you know, he can be second in a bunch sprint, or he can be second in a finish like today.
Yeah, and I wonder, you know, on the psychological point, if he was in another team, whether that would be something they would be urgently looking at. Can we look at the reasons why he gets into the positions? He does everything bar get over the line first so often.
Should we give him a Pedlar de Charme t-shirt as a something? Do you think that'll help break the cycle?
I don't think the Pedlar de Charme t-shirt is a sort of, you know, it's not to be patronised, is it?
No, he was on very monosyllabic, laconic form, wasn't he, in the mixer, and he was asked how did he feel? And he just said, bad. And then he was asked whether he was sad, and he said, I'm not sad, that I'm pissed.
Funny little laugh that he does, which spoils everything, because he looks such an impressive, imposing guy. And he's got this funny little laugh.
Just another serious point, making lots of serious points tonight. A lot has been made of Sagan's tactical ineptitude. And I think I quoted something on Twitter the other day. A former teammate of his, an under-23 teammate, said he never had a clue about tactics. It was just something he didn't like. He just didn't like tactics. He thought that he could do without tactics. However, I don't think that that is really a satisfactory excuse, because like Lionel says, he does get into the positions. And it's also, and also this idea, I mean, I've had conversations on this tour with his agent, Giovanni Lombardi, who said everyone rides against Peter. But I don't think that makes much difference. I think it's a physiological thing that he has gone backwards. He cannot do the things that he was once able to do.
Tactically, he rode pretty well today. We're going to play in the next part of the podcast a very interesting interview with Richie Port, who I spoke to this morning. I had heard that Richie Porte was punched in the torso on the stage to La Paire Saint-Martin, the first mountain stage in the Pyrenees. It hasn't had a great deal of coverage, this story, but he was apparently punched by a spectator. And I wanted to speak to him about that and what he said about that and other incidents and about the general suspicion around Chris Froome and Team Sky was, I think, very emotional from the heart and very interesting. So we'll hear that later, but let's hear from somebody else who spoke to at the start. We had a very productive morning presenting Pedlar de Charme t-shirts, didn't we, Lionel? Geraint Thomas, finally he got his. Sepp van Marck looked absolutely delighted with his. He was really chuffed with that.
Yeah, Daniel dug his out of the boot of the car.
Well, let's face it, it's the only thing Sepp van Marck's won all year, isn't it?
That's true. Daniel, you are. If Bernardino saw you, what would he say? When I see pot-bellied cyclists wearing the yellow jersey, it makes me sick.
I'm not sure. Pot-bellied. I'm certainly not pot-bellied.
But you're not a Pedlar de Charme either.
No slouching in the Pedlar de Charme jersey, Daniel.
Anyway, let's hear from somebody else. I spoke to another Pedlar de Charme from a couple of days ago when he narrowly avoided cows on the descent of the Col du Tourmalet. Warren Barguil. I got a pronunciation lesson. Barguil.
You
do. We checked with Francois Thomaso last night. Yes. Yeah, beauty. Warren Barguil. So spoke to him at the start this morning. Daniel, I don't know if he'll recover from this. He looks absolutely disconsolate. Is that the right word?
Come on, just get on with it.
I spoke to Warren Barguil this morning and just asked him how his debut tour was going. Here he is. Warren, how are you? Bandaged up a bit there. You've obviously had a nasty crash, but how are you feeling?
I hope I feel better today. I still have some fluid in my body, and I hope it's getting better. And I've actually now 4 days where it's not mountain, but tomorrow it's again uphill finish. And I hope I am better for the Alp.
You had such a great first week, and obviously the mountains are where you excel. It must be disappointing to have had this bad luck in the mountains, but are you hoping to come good in the Alps? And what's your aim here? Is it top 10 overall or a stage win?
It's both, actually, because if I have the opportunity for stage, I go for the stage and I don't think about the GC on. Yeah, I have need to see how I recover, actually.
You're still a very young rider. This is your first tour. You're a great prospect for French cycling. How are you finding it? How are you enjoying the tour, if that's the right word?
Enjoy the first week, actually. Really, I pass in my own place, and I have the white jersey. It was, for me, it was incredible. And I say, if I have bad luck or not good legs, for me, it was already a good Tour de France.
And just finally, Warren, we had Francois Thomaso, the French journalist, on our podcast last night. He said you're a typical Breton. You're tough. You're single-minded.
Yeah, we are not French. We are Breton before, and it's really the temperament.
The particular Breton characteristic.
Yeah.
You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney, and Daniel Froebe. And now, le pédaleur de charme, supported by British Eurosport.
Okay, we heard there from Warren Barguil. And today's British Eurosport Pedlar de Charme, well, there are a few nominations for different riders. Greg Van Avermaet, obviously. Wilco Kelderman had a few nominations. Thomas de Gendt.
Michael Matthews had a nomination. I think that might be a good one.
Michael Matthews. Michael Matthews, we didn't expect him to still be in the race. And in fact, he was up there. He was 17th on the stage. He was riding to the start this morning with a selfie stick, I noticed. Interesting. Not sure if that qualifies for Pedlar de Charme. Michael Matthews, then. The other very popular nomination was Jean-Christophe Perrault, who had a terrible crash, ripped most of his clothes and his skin, left a lot of skin on the road.
It's a bit of a podcast policy not to give the Pedlar de Charme to someone who's just had a terrible crash, terrible abrasions. And yeah. Who?
I mean, he would qualify, I think, by virtue of the fact that he, on his way back, having finally got back within touching distance of the peloton, he collected a load of bottles for his teammates, stuffing them down his jersey. And I thought that was remarkable and certainly worthy of the jersey. But what do we think? Should we make it Jean-Christophe Pro? He was a very popular choice.
I think Michael Matthews.
Michael Matthews? Final?
Yeah, go on then. Go on then. It's a tough one today, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. Michael Matthews. Jean-Christophe Perrault might still win it another day. He's not a very charming peddler, though, it has to be said.
No,
he's no stylist, which is another criterion.
No, he chops away, doesn't he? Like some mountain bikers. Very choppy peddling style.
We just alienated our mountain biking audience.
That's not a criticism of mountain bikers. It's just that it's a very different way of pedaling, and Perrault was a mountain biker for a long, long time, and you know, he hasn't got the souplesse of a route.
He hasn't perfected cycling yet, has he?
No, there's still, you know, 9 days of Tour de France to go in which he can perfect his cycling, so that's fine.
Let's move on to a more serious topic. So we've decided Michael Matthews will be presented with Pedaleur des Charmes. As I mentioned earlier, I spoke to Richie Porte, the Australian, on Team Sky earlier. Chris Froome actually paid a glowing tribute to him after the stage in his press conference for the work that he had done. I mentioned that Richie Porte apparently had been punched the other day. He'd also tweeted about confronting some supporters who had shouted doper at him as he rode back to the bus. We're not going to talk a lot about the doping suspicion today. We're just going to play this interview from Richie Porte, which I think is interesting. So here is Richie Porte. Richie, I want to ask you about, you're holding your side there. You were punched the other day. Were you on the climb?
But that's not why I'm holding my side. But yeah, I mean, I was. I'm not going to name who it was, but with 3 kilometres to go, yeah, I got a full-on punch. You know.
Did you see who it was?
Not really. I mean, focused on trying to catch Quintana. So,
has anything like that ever happened before? Have you ever seen anything like that happen before?
I mean, it was sort of the same atmosphere on Alpe d'Huez 2 years ago. And I think, to be quite honest with you, it's getting to the point where some of these journalists whipping up all the rubbish that they are, and they need to be accountable a little bit for our safety as well. Do I deserve to be booed? You know, does Chris Froome deserve to have all this? I don't think so. I think, you know, maybe in 10 years' time they're going to see, you know, all these victories are legitimate, and you know, I still don't expect them to come back and apologise. But you know, I think it's just a disgrace that how some of these people carry on. They're just so anti whatever we are. At the end of the day, I'm a kid from Tasmania who moved to Italy to ride my bike, and look what's, you know, brought me to. I've never taken any shortcuts, and it's just a disgrace that you know, they're saying the same thing about Chris Froome. I mean, there's not many people you put your hand in the fire for, but all these guys on the bus, you know, I would actually do that because it's totally legitimate. I think just because this team's got its act together, we do everything right, and look at the tour we're having. I mean, yesterday we're, you know, you can't question that. You know, we're getting stuck in fourth room here, and the sevenness at the bottom of that climb yesterday, no other team had that, and that's just because we're so organised and committed.
I understand as well from your Twitter that you actually stopped and challenged somebody who shouted at you. What? How did that exchange go?
At the end of the day, I'm not a big guy, but if there's four guys standing there with, you know, and they booed me on the way up and then on the way back down, the, you know, insinuating that I'm injecting something, and then when you stop and they all say sorry and that there's no problem, I guess that just shows the calibre of people that they are, you know.
Is that what happened? They apologised?
Yeah, I mean, shut up quite quickly, you know. I know that that's not always the most, the best way to take it on, but it does get to a point that you are human, you can only put up with so much.
I mean, Chris is obviously putting up with these questions every day, and he seems very, very cool and calm, but is that really, is it getting to the point where it is affecting the team, or are able to keep your mind on the job?
To be honest, yesterday when they were, you know, giving him the abuse like that, I actually heard him laugh about it. So, you know, he's obviously got a thick skin, which you need with that yellow jersey.
I mean, he asked the other day, what more could he do as a clean athlete? Have you got, I know that this is something you've been interested in before. I know that you spoke to Ned Bolting about it a couple of years ago even. You know, how can we, I think you were reading the book about Lance at the time, The Secret Race, the Tyler Hamilton book. Is there anything more that you think you could do?
What else can you do?
A lot of people say release the data. Would you be in favour of that?
Yeah, but I mean, they don't really know what they're looking at. I mean, half of these experts, what do they even know what a watt is? I mean, they don't, do they? Yesterday when I was chasing Contador, Nibali, these guys, there's 320 watts. I mean, that's not that high. Okay, yeah, it's the end of 6 hour race or whatever, but release our data on what, I mean, they don't know how to interpret it. I mean, you've got these pseudo scientists with their stopwatch, and it's all you know, they've all got their opinions, and they're not necessarily right opinions, are they? I mean, you know, why just sit on their couch and criticize? I think get out and try and do it.
Follow us on Twitter at cycling_podcast or on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com.
So that was Richie Port at the start of the stage. He seemed quite emotional, quite upset, really. And, you know, I hope you found that as interesting as I did. Let's talk about tomorrow's stage, to Mond. Mond is a brutal climb. It's about 3 kilometres long, steep in places. You drive up it to the finish. It's on an airfield, isn't it? And you drive up and you think, this is absolutely brutal. And then it never really, you know, it doesn't cause too much damage. But I do remember, I think 2010, the tour went up there. And I do remember Contador and Schleck getting stuck into each other on that climb. I mean, it's most famous perhaps for Laurent Jalabert winning there in 1995, isn't it, Daniel?
It is. Very, very famous stage. Once a real sort of orchestrated coup from Once, sending multiple riders down the road to join up with Laurent Jalabert, who'd set off very, very early on a breakaway, what looked at the time like a breakaway that was doomed, and he really put Miguel Indurain's Benesto team to the sword, and the finish at Mond will forever be associated with that stage. Jalabert won it. It was Bastille Day as well, wasn't it? He was in the green jersey. It looked at that stage as though he could even challenge Indurain. He was the best rider pretty much in the world at the time, Jalabert. And the climb was subsequently, it's the Côte de la Croix Neuve, it's actually called. But it was renamed the Monte Jalabert. And the Tour de France organisers, ASO, have sneakily renamed it the Côte de la Croix Neuve. They're not using Monte Jalabert anymore, which they did for a while, because of the revelations in the Senate report 2 years ago about the 1998 Tour de France and Laurent Jalabert's samples, urine samples containing traces of EPO.
We mentioned Laurent Jalabert last night. You said we weren't going to talk about the doping thing again, but let's just briefly update on that. He said, Chris Froome was angry that Jalabert and Cedric Vasseur had made comments about the believability of his performance in the mountains. Daniel, you got a little update on that?
Well, just to say that Jalabert stands by his comments. I mean, Froome responded yesterday. He said that Cedric Vasseur and Laurent Jalabert, both riders who competed in the 1990s and who both now work on France 2 as summarisers or expert analysts, he said that they were in no position to judge, criticise, didn't specify why, but I think we knew what he was getting at. But yeah, Jalabert said Froome should listen back to specifically what he said and that he stands by all of it.
Interesting stuff. I do remember in 2010, the stage that went to Mont, a few riders after that said that it was the hardest stage of the race that year. Bradley Wiggins had a problem early on in that stage and almost didn't get back on at all. It was so full on. It was Alexander Vinokourov, I think, was on the rampage that day. And, you know, it was Indurain's Benesto team that was put to the sword in 95. The latest incarnation of that team is Nairo Quintana's Movistar team. They are the sort of team who might try and do something tomorrow.
Well, and there are some climbs before the final rise above Mont is, onto that airfield that you mentioned, Rich. I'm going to make a proposal that we talk to some people tomorrow about the dehydration factor, because I think that could be an interesting element of the last week of the tour. If it continues like this, I think the heat is really playing havoc with some riders. Thibaut Pinot suddenly started going well again yesterday. He said that was all to do with the fact that it cooled down, and it has been a very, very hot tour, and the dehydration is a sort of evolving process that you know, if you get dehydrated one day and then the next day and the next day, then it starts
to
build.
You cannot, rehydrating is not just a case of drinking water. This is a great opportunity to plug today's Kilometre Zero, which is about food, eating on the Tour de France. Lionel's done a great job, well done Lionel, with the chefs, some of the chefs on the tour, Cannondale Garmin and Tinkoff Saxo, chefs. It's a really fascinating insight into what the riders eat on the tour.
Lots of stuff I didn't know. The detail that goes into planning the diets, making sure that, you know, one of the big things before the big mountain stages is to ensure that the riders are hydrated to an optimum level, but without any kind of water retention. So they cut down leafy vegetables, you know, salads and things in the days running up. Really specific diet on rest days as well, just to kind of get the carbohydrates in, but in the right form so they're not difficult to digest. And there's a real, you know, we think of fine cooking as a kind of art, but there's a real science to the food preparation on the tour. And Daniel makes the absolutely pertinent point. It's been so hot for so many days that it's one of the things that you don't really consider when you're just watching the race, that every single person will be dealing with it in a different way. Some will be better tuned to their bodies and know, you know, perhaps more instinctively what they need to do. Some will just get dehydrated and will forget to drink. I mean, when you're in a team car, for example, one of the most consistent messages a sports director gives across to the riders sort of half hourly is, don't forget to eat and drink, guys, don't forget to eat and drink, because they're riding a bike race and they're not programmed automatically to remember to
also eat. Don't forget to pedal, guys.
Well, yeah,
don't forget to pedal,
obviously. But and so, yeah, the hydration, we saw riders dropping back and getting bottles, and even Chris Froome mentioned what a job it was today for the domestiques to go back, get enough bottles, going back every half an hour, 20 minutes, half an hour, to get enough bottles to make sure everybody's hydrated.
And I remember last year we talked about a very novel hydration strategy that we thought we heard from a good source, or I heard from a good source, Michael Rogers, the Australian rider, was employing. He was hydrating himself to a minimum, or to the minimum that would allow him to function properly, to also keep his weight down and also prevent that water retention. He was quite furtive, I remember, when we subsequently asked him about it. But the approach that he was taking, or allegedly taking, was that it was almost like a Formula One car. There was a balance to be struck between having enough fuel and keeping the car light, and that was the sort of approach that he was adopting in his, particularly on mountain stages, in his riding on mountain stages.
Well, it didn't do him any harm, did it, last year? He won a stage. I do recommend the Kilometre Zero on food and the chefs. It is really fascinating. Lots of really great insights in there.
One last thing. We don't talk very much about the landscape on the Tour de France. One thing I would like to mention is that tomorrow's stage, the first 100 kilometres, are, for my money, the most spectacular part of the whole tour route. I don't think we'll probably see much of them, but they're going to go through the Gorge du Tarn, the peloton, and I think in all my years of doing the Tour de France, that is the single most surprising and spectacular landscape that I've ever seen.
We stayed there in 2010 after that stage. It was quite stunning.
Yeah, but this whole stretch all the way across to Valence is pretty spectacular. Just beautiful parts of the countryside. You know, quite nice today. Just looks gentle and rolling, but the roads are grippy and hard, and tomorrow is even grippier and harder.
Right, well, we better say bonne chance to Daniel. Daniel, see you tomorrow. A bientôt. Au revoir. And all that. Lionel, he's not exactly doing the Giro jog there, is he?
No.
But he's mincing off.
No. Lots of interest in Freeb this year. You know, he's been on the French cycling podcast. He's on French radio tonight. You know, are we going to have to up his wage?
The cycling podcast is proving to be quite the platform for some people. Giro, Scogna Emilio, was the subject today of a big feature article on an Italian cycling website, photographing everything, with a picture of his I Must Confess t-shirt. A reminder that all our t-shirts are available
at
thecyclingpodcast.com. You can become a friend of thecyclingpodcast.com there as well. Yeah. Somebody asked today about when our doping special was going to go up. The plan is for that to go live on the rest day. We've put a lot of work into that over many months, so we're hoping it will go live on the rest day. And become a friend at thecyclingpodcast.com, where you can also find the shop and buy a t-shirt. Like Lionel, we better wait for Daniel to finish his French radio appearance, but then go to our lovely hotel.
This is the irony, isn't it? I mean, Daniel's been with us in the car for 3 days, and so far he's not stayed with us for two of those days. And tonight he's delaying our departure on the night we've got the best hotel of the tour, I think.
Not that we're bitter, no. But we'll wait for him and then head off. And we'll say goodnight for now, and we'll be back. No Kilometre Zero Saturday or Sunday. It'll be back on Monday, but we'll be back with our regular show tomorrow.
Yeah, if you've missed any of the Kilometre Zeros, they're all on the website, all in the same place, thecyclingpodcast.com. This week, what have we looked at? We've done, Richard, you did mechanics. That was excellent.
Crashes.
Daniel's crashes.
Food.
That was interesting. The food today. a different look at the tour, proving very popular, those episodes.
Got lots more for next week as well. So that's all for tonight. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Fribb.